As the Democratic National Convention gets underway in Philadelphia, there's a lot going on both nationally and within Illinois politics this morning. We talk about our Illinois Senator Dick Durbin's comments this morning at the DNC, State Senator Ron Sandeck's abrupt resignation Sunday night, and get a sense of how the Illinois Democratic delegation unity compares to their GOP counterparts last week. Also, there's new research out today that could help with diagnosis of the Zika virus. We speak with the University of Michigan scientist behind it and the director of the Advanced Photon Source at Argonne National Labs about its role in the discovery. Finally, Chicago fashion designer Lala Hale is just 17.
Me designing started in fourth grade a long time ago, and I started sewing in middle school. My clothes got a lot of attention by people asking me where did they come from. It's like, oh, I did it, and that's how it just developed into a business.
We talked to the CEO of her own clothing line. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Good morning. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As the Democratic National Convention gets underway in Philadelphia, there's a lot of news on both the national and Illinois political front. DNC head Debbie Wasserman Schultz is resigning over a leaked email scandal. Illinois Republican Senator Ron Sandeck also abruptly resigned yesterday evening. There's lots of other news, so we've expanded our regular Monday political segment to make it a DNC edition. And joining us live from Philadelphia are Illinois Public Radio's Amanda Vinicky and WBEZ's Tony Arnold. It's our Illinois Public Radio edition. Hey, guys. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla.
Hey,
so let's start with the Illinois delegate breakfast this morning. Amanda, why don't you start? And then, Tony, you want to fill in what lots of conversation this morning at the Illinois breakfast delegation. Was it all about State Senator Republican Ron Sandeck?
No, in fact, that didn't really come up at all. We did ask House Speaker Michael Madigan, do you hear anything? Do you know anything? And he said that he had no comment. Obviously, you know, Sandeck is a Republican and these are Democrats, and they really, the talk was focused, of course, on the presidential race. And then there was a lot of talk, some at the podium, otherwise in press scrums outside of the breakfast itself, about the governor's race in a couple of years. That was really what the talk centered on. I should add that they did have some labor leaders speak, as well as Jesse Jackson. So you have a lot of people waiting in the rooms and just listening and clapping along with some of the figureheads or key supporters of the Democratic Party. So that's what else went on.
Tony, before we get to the governor and all of that conversation, I wonder if you could set the scene for us. What are these breakfasts like?
The breakfast, I mean, this is a who's who of Illinois politics. This is set up like kind of in this place where you get off the elevator and immediately you see one of those powerful Chicago aldermen. You see House Speaker Michael Madigan there. You have people who are interested in running for higher office in the future, people who have run and failed for running for higher office in the past. But, and then you have, like, what's interesting about this year in particular, I think, is some of the Bernie Sanders delegates who are completely new to Illinois politics, who are here and kind of watching this and interacting with some of these high-powered people for the first time.
Yeah, and Tony, I want to get to that in a second, but can you, Tony, I wonder if you can answer, Amanda was alluding to conversation about the governor's race, and that was involving U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. What was that? And we've seen reports, this has been kind of a story that's kind of bubbled for the past couple of months about questions about whether Senator Durbin would be interested in being running for governor for Illinois. What happened this morning?
I think this is one of those things that happens that just kind of naturally it's on people's minds about not just what's the election of 2016 and what's going to happen in November 3 months from now, but also what happens in 2 years and 3 months from now in 2018. And so it took almost no time at all for the speculation about, well, who do the Democrats even have to run against Bruce Rauner, who it sounds like he's already pretty much said, like, I'm going to be running again. So the Democrats are saying, okay, who do we have? Who can go up against the incumbent here, who has kind of so many millions of dollars of his own money that we can actually, like, that can hold his own to Rauner? And so Dick Durbin's name has been tossed around. It's almost been like this whisper campaign up to now. where everyone's saying, you know who would be good? It would be Dick Durbin. And so today it was really, actually, this is the first time I've seen where he's been really confronted with this idea head on in a room full of his friends, really, right? It's a friendly Democratic crowd. And so,
with lots of reporters in the national media there.
With lots of reporters watching, right?
Right.
And so they had the Connecticut governor actually giving a speech saying, you know what you guys need is a Democratic governor. And it got this huge applause. And then a few people in the crowd were like, Durbin, yelling out Durbin. And he just kind of grew sheepish and was grinning. He didn't really react. And then it came up like three more times throughout the rest of the event, where Karen Yarbrough is kind of acting as the master of ceremony. She's a Cook County elected official. And she kept being like, you know, he was right. We do need a Democratic senator. And there'd just be this pause. And everyone's just looking
at a Democratic governor. And then everybody would look at him. Amanda and Tony, I don't know if you all saw I know you guys have been running around reporting lots of stories, but the Sun-Times has a story that just came out this morning saying that House Speaker Michael Madigan has confirmed that he's been speaking with Senator Durbin about challenging Republican Governor Rauner in the 2018 election. I love how at the 2016 presidential race, at the breakfast, everyone's talking about Illinois' 2018 gubernatorial race. But Amanda, did Senator Durbin say anything about this morning specifically?
No, we heard, in fact, that from the House Speaker. And he didn't say much other than that they had talked about it a few months ago, that it was a conversation. We don't know how that conversation went, whether there was any sort of agreement, just that there was one, and that you did have Madigan kind of say why he believes Durbin would be a good candidate. None of that is anything surprising. He's got the name recognition. He's got a solid record. You, as a Democrat, he's been vetted. Whenever you're thinking about running somebody new for office, you're worried about what sort of enemies or past ill deeds will come out of the woodwork. Clearly, Dick Durbin has been in public life for a very long time, so what's out there is already out there. So you had Speaker Madigan listing some of those virtues, but by no means saying that he necessarily was endorsing or getting behind Dick Durbin, merely that they had a conversation. When I say merely, that doesn't mean that we should all go crazy and think that Durbin is going to be running or anything. But it is significant to note that it was a conversation between, of course, the chairman of the Democratic Party of Illinois, as they are thinking about, as Tony noted, who possibly could be and even be competitive against Bruce Rauner, despite Rauner's lack of popularity right now in the polls. Obviously, the election is quite a ways away, so that could turn around, and he has all of the money really in the world to be able to try and keep his seat. So they need to find somebody strong if they're going to be competitive.
Amanda, Tony, either of you jump in here. I mean, I just am curious about the timing of this. Speaker Madigan normally is not super communicative with the press, but clearly saying this morning, wanting to make a point of saying, yes, we did have a conversation. Any thoughts as to why that all of a sudden now, 2 years ahead of time, this would be something that Speaker Madigan would feel like he needed to confirm publicly?
I mean, my answer to that was, I think there's a lot to be said about the relationship between Speaker Madigan and Governor Rauner right now as to why the Speaker would be okay talking about the Democratic primary 2 years out. During his Q&A, Madigan came over to the press, actually, and took a few questions from reporters who were there and kind of unloaded on Governor Rauner, talking about really making a lot of comparisons between Rauner and Donald Trump, talking about how they're both very extreme Republicans, and saying that with a negative connotation, of course. So I think that his openness to talk about Durbin in particular is interesting, just because it's a specific candidate or a specific individual, as opposed to just talking about generally. He easily could have said, given generalities about how we're going to have a competitive primary, looking forward to that, there'll be a spirited debate. He easily could have just used very generic adjectives and descriptors to talk about the 2018 election. But the fact that he's giving out a specific name and acknowledged this and was pretty open about it, I think shows that He's pretty eager to be working with a Democratic governor crafting a state budget as opposed to the current situation that they're in.
Right.
And let me add, Nyla.
Go ahead, Amanda.
This isn't necessarily a surprise. You know, every time that you have a convention, there's always going to be 2 years from then a governor's race. And that seems far to us. But if you're going to run a campaign, you need to raise a lot of money. You need to make sure that you have backers. You need to see who else will be part of that field. So it's going to be a very long process. And this is when you have all of the Democratic players together in one room, in one place. If it isn't now at a convention, we'll still be having this conversation come August at the State Fair when it's Democrats' day to go there. We'll have it next year at the Democratic State Fair when some of the candidates have actually been there. It's just sort of the calendar cycle. So it's not as if Madigan, you know, stood up at a podium and said, "Hi, everybody, wanted to let you know I've been talking about Dick Durbin." Part of this is the press. You know, we're looking to learn. Where do things stand? There is, of course, we all know because Governor Rauner has said that he plans to run again. Clearly, Democrats are going to need to put something up. We're all interested. Who is that going to be? Will there be a crowded field? Will it be competitive? Or does nobody want to go up against Rauner again and his money? So it's partially our questions. You know, we pressed Speaker Madigan, pressed Senator Durbin, and the other names that are tossed about. Are you running? What are you hearing? Are people asking you? So I think that we want to be clear on that as well.
Yeah,
we
thanks for that context. No, I appreciate that, and that's helpful context. We're speaking with Amanda Vinicky, Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. She's in Philadelphia in the same room with her other public radio colleague from WBEZ in Chicago, Tony Arnold, who's also a State House reporter. I wanted to ask both of you, again, we'll talk about the convention in just a minute, but the really surprising political news in Illinois of Republican Senator, State Senator Ron Sandeck resigning very abruptly last night. He said it was because of some cybersecurity issues. He said that began to cause him to reevaluate his continued public service and says that he is missing his family and the lives of his children and is resigning effective today. Amanda, Tony, really surprising news here. What information can you fill in for us?
Well, so just to be clear, it's representative.
Oh, sorry, representative. I'm sorry.
Briefly.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. He had served in the state senate as well. So I guess we could give him that title and let it carry over. But most recently, he's been in the Illinois House. He had a competitive primary last time around from the right, but he did eke out a win. And since then, he's really been a staunch ally of Governor Bruce Rauner. So he is literally, it is his job there. You pick somebody within your party to be the one that raises some heck whenever there is any legislation, standing up for the minority party, asking the questions. That has been Ron Sandeck's role. He's an attorney. He is good to speak, to give, you know, sound bites, to give an interview. He is very conversational, again, an attorney, so he can be pointed in these debates on the Illinois floor. So that is why it is so surprising, because he seemed like somebody who really was dedicated to the job, perhaps looking to move up in politics, and was, as I noted, an ally of Governor Rauner, not somebody who it would seem that the governor would want to oust or anything. It's just, other than that, we don't know. You know, Tony and I have both, of course, been at the RNC where Sandeck wasn't there, Governor Rauner wasn't there. As we talked about last week, a lot of Republican elected officials weren't present at the RNC, and now we're here in Philadelphia. So haven't seen Ron Sandeck himself to ask some of these questions, but it surely is surprising and an odd storyline, to say the least. Maybe this is a new hallmark, a new way, a new sort form of, you know, candidate and campaign warfare, moving to the social media sites. Maybe there's something more. Maybe it is just that he wanted to spend some more time with his children. At this point, it seems like we don't know anything other than that. As the only word I think that can be really used is that it is surprising.
Tony, also, it's surprising in the sense also that he leaves, as Amanda said, he was running for office, leaves $130,000 in his campaign account, according to the most recent filing. And I know that House Republican leader Jim Durkin sent a statement to Republican members saying that he spoke with Ron yesterday and respects his decision to resign. Tony, I guess at this moment, just lots of questions and not really answers. Would that be an accurate way to describe what's happening?
I don't have any reason to believe anything other than what's in the statement, at least that I've seen. I think what's interesting, my interactions with Representative Sandek have always been interesting. He's always been very available to media interviews, and I think what kind of stuck out to me most recently was during the Republican primary process. You know, Ron Sandek is from DuPage County, and he represents Downers Grove, and it's an interesting politically area to represent in Illinois government. And he was not a Donald Trump supporter, and I would talk to him, and I did several stories about his thoughts on the presidential race as somebody who didn't want to support Donald Trump and what that meant for him as a Republican in Illinois, and he was very willing to talk to me and just kind of wrestle with the ideas of what he was thinking about his party and his role and as a rising, you know, figure in the House of Representatives, and just sort of where we're going here as a country and as an Illinois Republican, what this meant to you. And I think that that's a pretty rare thing to get a public official to be willing to be recorded on microphone, you know, just really not with a clear soundbite or a clear direction of what he wanted to say, but just kind of wrestling with what this meant to him. That's something that I always kind of stuck out to me is just his overall willingness to be open about.
Right, open
about how
and
he was feeling about
right. Very accessible as well.
Yeah,
Tony, we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Tony Arnold and Amanda Vinicky. We just got a few more minutes left with them. We're going to talk about the actual DNC convention coming up. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking politics right now with IPR's Amanda Vinicky and WBEZ's Tony Arnold. They're joining us live from Philadelphia, where the Democratic National Convention has started today. Tony, you all have reported, and you were reporting, both you and Amanda. I'm curious the contrast between what you all saw last week at the RNC and this week. Certainly, the notion of unity among parties has been a predominant theme during this campaign, and there were lots of discussions last week about Trump nominees. And as Amanda, you noted, so many prominent Republicans that weren't even at the convention. Tony, what's your sense? And Amanda, you can weigh in after Tony. What's your sense of unity among the Illinois delegation this time? You mentioned there were a couple new Bernie Sanders supporters. Are they totally on board with Hillary Clinton and now Tim Kaine as her vice presidential pick?
I think one of the biggest differences between just covering the Illinois delegation, just looking at them from last week to this week is, I think last week I could have counted the number of elected officials on one hand, maybe two, depending on the day, who were there, because so many elected officials from the Republican Party skipped the whole trip to Cleveland. This week, you show up and it's one table, and it's more elected officials from the Democratic Party than last week combined. So I think that there's just more. It's just more Democrats, elected officials at least, who are here. And as far as the Bernie Sanders supporters that I've talked to from Illinois, so far at least, I was talking to one this morning. Her name is Rebecca Abraham. She's from Chicago's near Northwest Side and is a delegate for Sanders. She won election to be a delegate for Sanders. And she was saying that she gets a lot of – she's taking her cues from the candidate himself. So he endorsed Clinton, so she's going to vote for Clinton. And she's encouraging other Sanders supporters to do that. But if he hadn't done that, then maybe, you know, she'd be putting up, you know, following him, again, following his cues. She's getting her cues from the candidate. She was very open about that. But she did say that there's still maybe a third of delegates that she knows around Illinois here who are just really going to be some of these Bernie or bust types that you've been hearing about, over the last several months through this campaign. And so I'm trying to reach out to them and get to know them a little bit better over the next few days. Tonight's speech from Senator Sanders himself, I think a lot of them are really looking forward to. And I'm just kind of curious to see what some of the reaction within the Illinois delegation it looks like. That said, you know, the by and large, the message this morning has been we're going to unify if for no other reason than to stop Donald Trump from becoming president. We're going to unify as Democrats and behind Hillary Clinton. If even if you don't like Clinton, you're gonna unify behind her because it's no for no other reason than to stop Trump.
Yeah, Tony, thanks for that. Amanda, I wonder. I think people often forget that Hillary Clinton was actually born in Chicago, spent a little bit of time in Park Ridge. Does that matter to people or the Illinois delegation? Are people talking about that? That hey, the nominee was someone who was actually born in Illinois.
Yeah, a little bit of that. You know, you have the logo for the Illinois flag has an IL in it. I talked to somebody who just said, yeah, you know, she was born here. Clearly, it's been a while. And once you become a senator for the state of New York, I guess you become there.
Right. Everyone. Right.
Exactly. But you do have, I ran into somebody who is an acquaintance of hers from law school at Yale, so not during a time in Illinois, but for sure, that is an underlying element of things. Yeah.
Well, I know that, Tony, you mentioned, obviously, former candidate Senator Sanders is going to be speaking this evening. I know also Illinois Representative Luis Gutierrez is speaking tonight. He's talking about immigration. What other themes can we expect to see this week?
Oh, I think from Illinois in particular, you're also going to be hearing later this week Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth taking the stage. I think she's going to get a prominent speaking role at the national convention stage because she's running for the U.S. Senate seat currently occupied by Mark Kirk, and that's a big, very competitive seat. A lot of Democrats see this as a very winnable seat for Duckworth, and I think you're going to hear her, a lot of the themes throughout that campaign so far has been her military experience and record. Now, Mark Kirk has very similar things as well. So you've already seen some of the ads about that race. And I think as far as, again, Illinois is concerned, I suppose, you know, Raja Krishnamoorthy was another candidate who got a kind of a prime speaking role before the Illinois delegation this morning. He's running for Congress in the suburbs. So, and also, I guess the third thing I'd add is there's already been, I don't know how many comments comparing Governor Rauner to Donald Trump this morning from various speakers. I think that's going to be an ongoing theme that we're going to be hearing throughout the week.
Well, and it's an interesting thing, Amanda, given the fact that certainly, I'm not sure how fair a comparison that is to Governor Rauner. He won't even mention Donald Trump by name. He's certainly the governor has been very careful about not talking about Donald Trump or his support of him at all.
Yeah, that is true. And yet he did say that he would support the Republican nominee. And obviously, that is Donald Trump. So you have that going. I think that there are some similarities, at least when it comes to a surface level. Both are businessmen who ran on the record of look at the success that I've had elsewhere, who ran on the notion that they weren't part of government or politics and that it's best to have an outsider. So you have those similarities, and both also have said, you know, I'm wealthy, I'm able to fund my own campaign, I don't have to worry about these special interests, and further, I don't need this job, that it's not something I'm doing for the paycheck. I'm not sure how many, you know, presidential candidates that you get that are really doing it for the paycheck, but nonetheless, it's something that resonates with voters. So those are the similarities. You're right. There are some very clear differences when it comes to policy, and I think just in their mannerisms, their agendas going forward. But I think, see some similarities. And given I think the political calculation, why you're seeing Democrats try and tie Governor Rauner and Donald Trump together is because the calculus by Illinois Democrats is that Trump won't do well here, and so that they are best served to do that, and that will help to tear down Republicans.
That's IPR's Amanda Vinicky. Thanks also to WBEZ's Tony Arnold. We look forward to your reporting this week from the DNC. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Zika virus has been spreading throughout South and Central America and the Caribbean. And in the past week, there's been two possible cases of locally transmitted Zika infection in the continental U.S. Both of those are being investigated by health officials in Florida. Next week, the CDC will begin making awards of nearly $60 million to states, cities, and territories to support efforts to protect Americans from the Zika virus and its dangerous results, most prominently the serious birth defect microcephaly. We have a lot to learn about the Zika virus, including how it spreads and how to accurately diagnose it. But a new study published today by Midwestern scientists helps solve at least one piece of the Zika puzzle and may lead to development of better diagnostic tools. Joining us now to explain what they've done is Janet Smith. She's a professor of biological chemistry in the Life Sciences Institute at the University of Michigan, where she joins us from. We're also joined by Stephen Schreifer, who's director of the Advanced Photon Source at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont, where a portion of this study was carried out. Janet, Stephen, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having us on.
Good morning, Nyla.
Janet, good morning. Your research team determined the structure of one of the proteins involved in the Zika transmission. Can you explain why it's important to start there with that protein structure with a virus?
Well, this is but one piece of a very complicated puzzle. And the protein that we have studied is called, boringly, NS1. And it has many properties, many functions to help the virus propagate within an infected person and also to sneak around and hide from the patient's immune system. And what we wanted to do was to see ways in which the NS1 protein from Zika virus might be a little bit different from the NS1 protein structures that we had previously published from West Nile virus and dengue virus. And that's why we set out to study it.
And now the Zika virus, is in the same family as viruses as West Nile and dengue? Is that correct?
Absolutely. And it's definitely in the same family. And the reason that the diseases are so very different is that the virus gets into different cells in an infected person. So that really is what leads to different clinical outcomes, but all the molecular details about these viruses, which include the dengue viruses, the four serotypes, and West Nile, yellow fever virus, Japanese encephalitis virus, there are a bunch of them, the molecular details are quite similar.
And I know that because those molecular details are quite similar, making an accurate diagnosis and determination of whether someone has Zika compared to West Nile or dengue has been difficult so far for researchers. How might this new information that you all have worked on and released today, how might that help solve that problem?
So that's exactly right. One of the things we were looking for is ways that the Zika NS1 protein is a little different, particularly than the dengue NS1 proteins, because the parts of the world where this Zika virus outbreak has occurred are endemic for dengue infection. And so one of the things that's been particularly tricky with Zika infections is that the virus itself disappears from a person's bloodstream very, very quickly after they're infected. And so, for example, if a pregnant woman wants to know if she's been infected with Zika virus, you can't look for the virus very long. And it's important to have diagnostic tests, but people produce antibodies to things that we all do that we're infected with. And a standard diagnostic test is to look for antibodies that we might have to things we've previously been infected with. And there was a lot of a positive on a Zika test didn't necessarily mean the person had been infected with Zika. They might have been infected with dengue. And so we need to have much more accurate tests. And what we can do is take the structure of the protein, which we know now, and the structure of the dengue protein and compare them. They have the same internal architecture, but on the surface of the protein, they look a little bit different. And so we can pick the pieces, the places where they differ, and use those to develop diagnostic tests. And I think that might be very, very helpful in coming up with much more accurate diagnoses of previous Zika infections when people have very big life decisions to make based on the results.
So it sounds like this is helping make clearer diagnoses. And Stephen, I wanted to bring you into the conversation because you all, I know Janet worked with you at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont. Can you explain? She worked with the Advanced Photon Source machine. What is that, the APS?
So the Advanced Photon Source is, at its heart, a really big machine to produce X-rays. And these are exactly like the X-rays that you get in a dentist's office or a doctor's office to be able to perform medical tests there. But instead, what we're doing is we're using those same types of X-rays, but much more intense, a billion times more intense than you get in the doctor's office, to be able to look inside of materials and to look at the atomic structure of materials and also atomic structures of proteins, exactly in the way that Janet is looking at the atomic structure of a virus protein.
And Janet, maybe you can explain why you needed this really high-powered X-ray beam to look at these proteins. Is it because they're so small?
Not because the proteins are small, but because the proteins are a little bit tricky to make. And in order to get this very detailed and rich atomic structure of the protein molecule, 3D structure of the protein molecule, we need to make a little bit of it very pure and happy, convince that protein to crystallize, and take those teeny, 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 tiny little crystals and put them in the X-ray beam at the APS at Argonne. And we look at the way the X-rays are scattered by the crystal, and from that information, we can deduce the atomic structure of what's inside. But I have to say that the synchrotron is absolutely essential for all of this kind of research. I mean, we're not the only ones who are doing important, biomedically important protein structures at the synchrotron. There are many, many other examples. And what they've done at Argonne and at the APS in particular is truly amazing. I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation last year and calculated that we have our crystals are teeny, like 10 microns, very small.
And how remind us the size of a micron, Janet?
I'm not going to be able to do the math.
Stephen, can you quantify the size
of the analogy?
Okay.
Absolutely. So if you think about a human hair is about 100 microns in diameter. So the protein crystals that Janet is working with are about 1/10 of the size of a human hair, and that's on each dimension. So these things are really tiny. You have to use a microscope to even be able to locate them into the X-ray beam.
So they're really tiny, right. And then, Janet, go ahead. You were going to talk about
the beam of X-rays that we use is matched in size to that 10-micron crystal. But the beam, the place where we put the crystal and the place where the beam is made are 70 meters apart. So that's like 2/3 of a football field. And you have to hit that little old 10 micron thing day in, day out, all the time till you get your experiment done. It takes a little while and not move out of the way. And so the math that I did was to say, well, okay, let's pretend that crystal is 1 foot in diameter. So I came up with a Halloween sized pumpkin. And how far would that pumpkin be from where they generate the X-rays? And if you put the pumpkin in Juneau, Alaska, and you put the X-ray source in Washington, D.C., that's what it would be.
Wow. That's proportionally the difference.
An amazing, amazing engineering feat that they've accomplished at the Argonne Synchrotron. It's fabulous. And it's essential to this kind of work.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Janet Smith and Stephen Streifer. We're going to find out a little bit more about the Advanced Photon Source, which is in suburban Chicago, a little bit more about how it works, how it helped this research into Zika, and who else uses it. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute. We'll be right back. Gina Labudu. Welcome back to the 21st. We're talking about new research published today by Midwestern scientists at the University of Michigan and Purdue University that are helping solve one piece of the Zika puzzle. Scientists, including Janet Smith, who's on the line with us from the University of Michigan, were looking at the protein structure of the virus. They were able to do that by using the advanced photon source at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont. Its director, Stephen Streifer, is also on the line with us. Stephen, we were just talking about how this is really like a nanoscale. Microscopic isn't even the right word for what you all were doing with these protein structures. How do you, now my understanding is these are very tiny images, but they come from a very large machine. Can you describe how big the APS is?
Yeah, it's always funny. The smaller that it is that you're trying to look, it seems like the bigger the machine you need. So we're a baseball stadium-sized facility. Actually, if you fly into Midway Airport, we're pretty easy to spot. We're just southeast of the intersection of...
What does it look like?
It's a big round building. Sort of looks like a big warehouse. It's a kilometer in circumference, so about two-thirds of a mile. And the big round building houses our electron beam storage facility that we use to create the X-rays that are used by experimenters.
We'll tweet out a picture of that, actually, so you can see it. So you can see it. If you're landing at Midway, you can see how big this is. And how does it do its work, Stephen?
So it's actually quantum mechanics in action. So, and I'll spare people the details of that. But basically, the way that it works is we have a circular vacuum chamber. Again, this thing's that's a kilometer in circumference. And we circulate an electron beam inside of that. And then at 69 places around the ring, we pass this electron beam through arrays of permanent magnets. And those permanent magnets cause the electron beam to wiggle back and forth, and it's that wiggling that gives off the X-rays. And it's precisely because of that that these machines are so useful. By doing that in exactly the right way, we produce exactly the right wavelength that researchers like Janet need at these really, really high intensities that are well beyond what you can get in a laboratory-based system.
And who uses this? Janet mentioned before the break that it's very helpful to her. What other do other scientists or private companies also, scientists from universities as well as private companies, use the APS?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a general scientific user facility that's funded by the Department of Energy. So we have about 5,300 unique users each year. It turns out the life scientists like Janet make up about 35% of those users each year, and the rest of them are distributed along disciplines such as material science, chemistry, engineering, physics, and a whole number of other scientific disciplines. About two-thirds of our researchers who come here are academics, so it's quite a broad community, but we have quite a few companies who work here as well. Researchers who use us and intend to publish the work use us for free. That's what the Department of Energy supports us for. Companies who come to us to do proprietary work, we charge them cost recovery for that work, but that's part of the thing that we need in the U.S. to be able to generate the intellectual basis for the economy and for our knowledge base.
And how many people have used this over the past year?
Over the past year, it's about 5,300 people, and that is counted in a very strict way. So that turns out to be about of the order of about 5,000 experiments that are done each year.
Oh, wow. Using the, and how unique is the advanced photon source?
So we're the world's brightest source of hard X-rays, brightest source in the Western Hemisphere, I should say. So there are similar machines to this in Japan and Europe, but that really points out the international landscape in which the U.S. is working in. We have to maintain competitiveness in science and technology to be able to serve researchers in the U.S. like Janet who need the sorts of capabilities that we can provide.
And in the case of what Janet was doing, she was looking at the molecular structure of the Zika virus. Is this also used to, what other ways do people use this X-ray machine?
We have an enormous number of experiments that go on at any one time. We can have up to 69 that are operating at any one time. So a lot of the work that's done here is exactly the type that Janet is talking about, where we have various types of biological materials that have been crystallized, and we're looking at the atomic structure. But that ranges all the way up to work that both researchers and companies are doing, for instance, to look at diesel fuel sprays and engines. The X-rays that we produce are very good at penetrating things like a diesel fuel injector made of steel, and we can look at the details of the fuel spray that comes out of that injector, again, at very high resolutions, at fractions of the width of a human hair.
Janet, now that you have been able to, using the advanced photon source, have a little bit more sense of this protein involved with the Zika virus, what's the next step for you all?
So we're going to use this information, we've already begun to use the information in collaboration with other researchers who are trying to develop better diagnostic tools. It's also possible that bits and pieces of NS1 could be used to develop a vaccine. And as I said in the beginning, the virus is a bit of a puzzle. And understanding the many molecular functions of NS1 is greatly facilitated by having the structure. And so we're involved in collaborative research with our virology colleagues at Purdue University and also the NIH to understand and sort of tease out. We've discovered some new functions of the protein, having known its structure, that we weren't aware of before. And these could possibly lead to treatments. I think diagnostics and vaccines are the more likely practical outcome.
Gina, do you have a sense that there's enough scientists across the country and the world working on the virus and figuring out both diagnoses, as you've said, as well as possible treatment?
Oh, absolutely. I've been very, very impressed with the speed with which the research community has gotten onto this problem and how they've really helped. People are working much more collaboratively and cooperatively and releasing information much more quickly because of the public health emergency than they would in an ordinary competitive scientific situation. And I have to say, I'm also very grateful that the press is reaching out to the research community to try and get accurate information to the public as quickly as possible. It's a mystery, and it's going to take some time to really get things sorted out, but there are a lot of very smart people working on it.
And one of those smart people is Janet Smith. She's a professor of biological chemistry in the Life Sciences Institute at the University of Michigan. Janet, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Nyla.
I also want to thank Stephen Streifer, who's the director of the Advanced Photon Source at Argonne National Labs in Lamont in suburban Chicago. Thanks, Stephen.
It's been a pleasure.
Finally, to wrap up the hour, summers aren't as relaxing as they could be for recent high school graduate Lala Hale. Instead of hanging out with her friends before she starts college, when she gets out of bed in the morning, she heads straight to her design studio inside her house. The 17-year-old fashion designer works at least 8 hours a day and takes a day off every once in a blue moon. She's the CEO of her own clothing line. It's called Rich Temper, and she joins us now from her home studio on Chicago's South Side in the Pullman neighborhood. Hey, Lala, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you started designing in the fourth grade. What prompted that?
A student had brought Barbie clothing stencils that you use like to draw on paper in the class I got to it before I did. So I was prompted to just make my own by hand, and then that's how it started. And then going into middle school, I did have consumer ed classes, so sewing was one of my classes. So I started by making a pillowcase and a duffel bag and a locker caddy. Like, it started very simple.
And how did you start? How did you go from that to clothes?
It all started when, you know, as you grow up, you grow into like your own physique and your own unique person. It's like going into stores, not everyone has the same style or things don't fit the way that you want. So that's what influenced me to just start a clothing line, or start making my own clothes, at least, when I couldn't find things that I would have wanted to wear.
Yeah, what were you looking for that you couldn't find?
I was looking for, like, pencil skirts that were for the petite but curvy young woman, or jackets, like bomber jackets or blazer jackets that weren't my size. I couldn't find in the store, but I would go home and I'll make them, and I'll put, like, certain patterns on them, color block. I'll be like really creative with my design.
Yeah, how would you describe your style, Lala?
I would describe my style as street chic. That's what a name that I've came up with. I say street chic because a mixture, like a street wear, is mainly like bomber jackets, biker jeans, Chelsea boots, you know, dark colors. And then the chic part is like where I get like, oh, I like to wear dresses, I like to wear pencil skirts, I like to be classy. But there is a merge of the two when it comes to the things that I design.
Yeah, and I've seen some of designs you've had. I saw we're tweeting out some pictures of Lala's design. If you follow us, 21st Show, it's 21st Show, and on your Instagram, some really cool. Like, I don't know what your favorite colors are, but I saw some dresses that were pale pink. What's your favorite color scheme? Is there one?
I do have a fave color scheme, and it does go along like with my favorite season, which is fall. So I'm really into the olive greens, the pale blush pinks, maroons, dark purples, browns, nudes, all nudes are good. And that's what like I just go off of when it comes to developing a collection, especially for fall.
And Lala, you're CEO of your own company. You started your own clothing line. You started actually that back in 2014, so 2 years ago. How did that come about?
Seeing that a lot of people liked what I was wearing, and a lot of people would question, like, oh, where'd you get that? And it's like, well, I made it. And they're like, oh, can you make me one? So it's like, oh, well, why not make it a business? Like, why not give my clothes a name and identity so when people see it, they're like, oh, that's Rich Temper. So that's where I just decided to just brand my lifestyle, basically.
Right. And you've tweeted, you don't have to be rich to look and feel rich. So how do you think that is an expression in your clothes?
I think it expresses itself that my clothes have a lot of quality, but you don't need to have the Chanel money or the Louis Vuitton money, and that may be your taste, but you know, you can get all like similar items for a much lower price and still look the part.
Now, I know you create all of your designs by yourself and you hand make them. Do you do that in your home studio? Where else do you work?
No, I do everything in my home studio. I work off 4 machines. I have racks. I have tons and tons of bins of material. I work solely from home.
Wow. And who would you say are your biggest inspirations?
My biggest inspiration would be Alexander Wang. Not that he does anything himself, but his style and the way that he's passionate about sticking with like his genre of style. So that's who I look up to as far as looking for streetwear and trying to collab with what I really like, which is like chic wear.
So I wonder if you're thinking about prospective clients, and I'm thinking about Alexander Wang. Wang, you're 17 and you're from Chicago, and so is the first lady at the moment. And we know she picks a lot of American designers. Would you prefer to dress first lady Michelle Obama or Sasha and Malia?
I would prefer to go for Sasha and Malia. I feel like I could really make them stand out in a good way, in a way that they've never been seen before.
And have you had, how hard has it been to start your own company?
It has been very difficult. And also being a student, you kind of have to juggle. It's not like, oh, one's over the other. It's kind of like when you have people's money and people invest time in you, it's like you have to know, it has to be a really good balance. And so it wasn't like, oh, school first, business first. It was like they're equally important for me to get accomplished.
And do you have outside?
So that's like my biggest task.
Right. And do you have outside investors in the clothing line at the moment?
No, I have not finalized with any outside investors. Right now, my manager is my only investor.
We just have a minute or two left, Lala. I just want to ask what your fashion advice might be for women who want to have that street chic style that you have for the summer, or maybe even if you want to. I know you're probably thinking about the fall right now.
I'm thinking about all seasons, but my advice would be wear what you want and own it. It doesn't matter what you wear or what the weather is, because we all see Kim Kardashian wearing huge furs in Los Angeles heat and you wonder why, but it's all about a fashion statement. And you just flaunt what you know, what's your preference, and you wear with attitude, and that's where Rich Temper comes from.
Lala, where are you headed to this fall for college?
I am headed to Savannah College of Art and Design at the Atlanta campus.
And what's your goal after college?
My goal is to establish a few boutiques, and I would love to go bigger into department stores. But first and foremost, I would love to have a name of my own.
So that's Lala Hale. She's 17, based in the Pullman neighborhood in Chicago. Her clothing line is called Rich Temper. Hey, Lala, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today on the 21st. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. If you have it, you can search for the 21st. If you want to find shows on iTunes and Android, we're available there. All of the links and every other way to contact us, whether that's phone, email, or social media, is all at our website at www.21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.